My name is Erica Sugo Anyadike. I'm Tanzanian, but I began my career in South Africa as a screenwriter, and I worked in various capacities in the television sector.
Welcome to our limited series highlighting the 2020 shortlist of the AKO Kane Prize, an annual literature prize awarded to the writer of an African short story published in English. The prize was launched in 2000 to encourage and highlight the richness and diversity of African writing by bringing it to a wider audience internationally. The focus on the short story reflects the contemporary development of the African storytelling tradition.
When I worked in broadcasting, I created briefs and commissioned television series that dealt with issues such as apartheid, sexuality, and gender. That was still a passion of mine when I moved to Kenya, so I began to produce my own content, and I guess I've never shied away from events and real-life issues that intrigued me. Although I did once make a short film about a boy who believed he had superpowers, so maybe Marvel will call me after this. But no matter what content I was making, I always ensured that I kept my focus on characters, emotions, and story. I started to dabble in short stories and got published in Kwani, which is a Kenyan literary magazine. It was actually started by Binyavinga Wainana, who had won the Kane Prize in previous years and has unfortunately passed on, but he started a legacy that continues to this day. And then after that, I got shortlisted for several prizes, and most recently, I've been shortlisted for the AKO Kane Prize. My passions are writing and mentoring, and I think it's important to pay it forward. So I guess every time I'm writing, those are some of the things that I try to do in my work to inspire other young women who are coming up behind me. And also, I think, to give credit to the women who've gone before me. If I was a fictional character, I would be Myrna from Alice Walker's story, Really Doesn't Crime Pay? In that story, Myrna is a young woman married to a husband who's a war veteran and a businessman who disparages her desire to write and wants her to sit at home. Man seduces her and steals her story ideas, and she becomes depressed and resentful. And Luel tries to impregnate her. Luel is the war veteran husband. He tries to impregnate her and insists that a baby will keep her occupied and lift her spirits. And she tries to cut his head off with a chainsaw. It sounds more gruesome than it really is, because the writing is actually exquisite. But ultimately, I think the point that Miss Alice Walker is writing about, and the point that she's trying to make, is really about resistance and survival and appropriation. And basically, you know, the story is asking, what does it mean to be a Black woman writer in a hostile world? And I love that story, and I love that character, and I think the question is still relevant today. If I were a song, I would definitely be a song titled Green Eyes. Green Eyes is a song by a songwriter and a singer called Erica Badu from her album Mama's Gun. And so, you know, I like that song, not because my eyes are green, they're not, and not because she's my namesake, which she is, but because the song itself is a 10-minute towering testament to the complexity of what it means to be a woman. And in that song, Erica Badu is basically writing about a woman who's going through growing pains, going through the demise of her relationship with her son's father. It's a song that moves through three different suites, meaning that it changes tempo as she takes us on a journey of jealousy, resignation, and finally resolution. And her pain is so raw, you know, it's almost like you feel like you're reading her diary, like you feel like you're a voyeur. And it's a jazzy Billie Holiday-esque sort of ballad slash torch song, and it's cinematic and it's operatic in scale and in scope. It tells a story in 10 minutes and it takes you on a journey. But above all else, I love Green Eyes because it's an incredibly honest piece of work. It's unflinchingly honest. And that's the quality, ideally, that I'd like my work to have. I'd like my work to be like that song, to talk about, you know, what is ugly, what is beautiful. I think a lot of people don't have access to what I'm about to say, which is incredibly simple information. But I think a lot of people are intimidated by the writing process. The best writing advice I have ever received is that writing can be taught, or rather that it can be learned. It is absolutely true. For some reason, people internalize that they're either writers or they aren't, which is a very kind of mystical ivory tower sort of concept. And you know, sure, you do have to have the desire to write, but it's more important to realize that it's a craft just like anything else. You can absolutely, absolutely get better at it if you apply yourself. You don't need to go to expensive MFA programs. I mean, honestly, just YouTube University, as we say. You need the internet, yes, and you do need determination, and you absolutely need the discipline to practice. But above all, you need a love of language and a love of reading. The point is, it is absolutely accessible to everyone, and I really wish that more people knew that. The first person I told about being shortlisted for the AKO Kane Prize was my partner. And so I ran up the stairs and I burst into the bedroom and I woke him up and I was breathing heavily, you know, more from excitement, not exertion. I can actually make it up a flight of stairs. I do try to exercise regularly. But, you know, I think he might have thought we were being burgled initially, but eventually the words came out and I was completely thrilled and, you know, he was happy for me.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Erica. What time of day do you write and why?
So I read that Toni Morrison says that she gets up before dawn and she watches the sunrise and then she has a cup of coffee and then she sits down to write, which is wonderful because I do think that writers need rituals. And I thought like, wow, if getting up before dawn is good enough for Toni Morrison, then it's good enough for me. I have to be honest, I don't always get up before dawn, but I do get up early in the morning. And I'm definitely a morning person for sure. I think better in the morning, I'm more productive, more motivated. And, you know, I feel like it's a slow process of attrition as the day wears on. So I prefer to write in the morning because I'm definitely a lark and not an owl. I think, again, like I said earlier, it's important to have a ritual and to stick to it. And particularly for writers who have families, the earlier in the day you can write, I think the better it is for most of us. Otherwise, the day can run away from you and you have to attend to other people and other work and, you know, even other tasks. So normal life stuff. I think morning is the best time of the day to write and it works for me. I want everybody to read my work. And, you know, why shouldn't they? I'm a human writing about other human beings, hopefully in a humane way. I write to and for and about Black women. But I'm also a believer in the saying that the more work is rooted in a specificity, the more universal it is. We all experience emotions. We all enjoy work by people that on the surface would probably appear to have nothing in common with us. But we've watched films about diverse characters and we've rooted for them and we've understood what motivates these characters. So I feel if I've done my job as a writer properly, then hopefully readers of all kinds will be able to engage with my work. When I think of the role that literature has in shaping politics, I think of how my own politics were shaped by reading Alice Walker and reading Toni Morrison. A large part of the way I view the world is due to the horizons that these women opened up for me. They raised my consciousness and expanded my awareness. And I think it would be a serious omission not to say that I constantly watch myself to check if I'm reproducing a dominant gaze. You know, we internalize a lot more than we're aware of, and we have to guard against perpetuating tropes about class, about race or gender. At least that's the way I feel. But, and this is a big but, I'm naturally guarded against, you know, lofty statements such as shaping politics or showing us a way to live. Those are really weighty statements. Whereas I think what drew me to Toni Morrison and Alice Walker was empathy. You know, the love that they had for their characters, the love that they had for language. They were also artists whose work can actually be judged purely on aesthetics. And I think it's very, very important that we emphasize that they were good writers first and foremost, masters of their craft. Being Black and female and a writer, I think is already an act of resistance. It's already a political stance. The only thing that differs is the degree to which the politics inform the work. I think what is most often missing from conversations about African and African diaspora literature is the fact that people don't often talk about craft and the diversity that we're seeing in African literature lately. I'm very happy that Ella Wakatama Alfrey mentioned it, but I'm waiting for the majority to catch up. You know, Audre Lorde, who's also a writer, an African-American woman, said that the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. And Ngugi wa Thiong'o also talked about decolonizing the mind. And I think that Anglophone African writers are taking the English language and trying to sculpt it in service to their goals and their aims. And they're reshaping those tools and rebuilding their houses. The fact is, because of colonization and a global economy, most people speak and read in the languages of former colonies. And that said, writers are using craft as a form of creative resistance, and we should acknowledge that. Good African writers are good writers, period. Not good for an African. They're just good, full stop. And in terms of the breadth and the depth of the topics and the genres that African writers are currently writing about, we need to celebrate that instead of, you know, ghettoizing African literature. Even ghettoizing is a loaded word, but for lack of a better phrase, we need to stop placing people into boxes that they haven't necessarily signed up for, into labels that they haven't agreed to carry. So I think we should just celebrate the multiplicity of narratives and our people. And I'm looking forward to a day when, you know, literary critics and just audiences in general become more open to that. After the wedding, he will offer you an opportunity to redecorate. Suspect he is proud that he understands women and their petty torments. You'll pout and tell him how hard it is to live with his first wife's lingering memory haunting the house. You'll swear you've seen doors open and shut by themselves, heard footsteps, but see no one there. Remain adamant that there are ghosts. He will be exasperated in that short, sharp way you'll come to learn he has, but soon he'll acquiesce, ordering plans from several renowned architects to build you the palace of your dreams. Feel relieved. Feel his first wife's tastes were too simple. Feel you are the president's wife. You should live like one. The wives of rich, well-traveled men will want to be your friends. If anybody sneers at you for being a secretary, then it will be done in whispers, behind walls. In restaurants, you'll be ushered into VIP sections. If you want anything, someone will be immediately dispatched to go and get it. And all you'll have to do is just immerse yourself in charity work, open a few orphanages, kiss a few babies, and accompany the president to state events. This would be bearable if it wasn't so boring. Resent having all this money and looking like everybody else. Seem quiet and withdrawn when rubbing his feet. Remember your aunt's lesson. Better to be wily than to whine. Tell him, the wife of such a big man like him should be better dressed. Aren't you a reflection of him and his largesse? He will agree, and a series of shopping trips will begin. You will travel overseas for haute couture. Local fashion will not do for you. Have a personal shopper at Harrods. Jealous journalists will give you a nickname, something alliterative. You'll be proud of the moniker. It's catchy and has a ring to it. Draw the line at photographers. Have them assaulted for taking pictures carelessly. Words will be one thing, but even you suspect that pictures are a bad idea. A drought does not mean you need to give up your Dior, but perhaps it's best not to give your enemies too much ammunition. And you do have enemies, you do. They're powerless for the most part, but they are there. Meet someone. He will shower you with attention and affection. Fall harder than you thought possible. Become focused on him and only him. Exchange endearments. Fantasize about a future together. Come up with code names so you don't get caught. You'll call him John. Someone will tell your husband. He will ask you outright if you're having an affair. Deny this. Fear stuck like a lump of mealy meal in your throat. No. No one betrays the president and gets away with it. Warn your beloved. John will travel, planning to stay out of the way until things cool down. You'll talk on public telephones, paranoid that someone has tapped the landlines. He'll become restless and want to return. Capitulate and admit that everything seems to have returned to normal. Though you feel the opposite, say, it is probably safe. Arrange to meet. You'll wait at the appointed place for hours and hours, expectations souring your mouth like bad milk. He will not pitch. The next day, you'll hear of his death. The president will deliver the news over breakfast, fake sympathy for John's family's loss while eating fried eggs. Hear the words car accident. Bite your tongue to keep from crying. Under the table, you'll grasp the knife so hard that your palm will bleed. Stop eating for 3 days. Conspiracy theories will swirl like fog, and you'll wander around listlessly, asking questions to uncover answers you already know. You sense the whispers as you enter rooms, the words love affair lingering in the air, the disapproval left behind like a bad stench. You'll walk around unable to mourn. The only permissible sign of your black mood will be the slow shuffling of your feet. At your lover's funeral, neither his wife nor his brother will look at you, although they're required to shake the president's hand. Adjust your dark sunglasses. Try to stem the tears without dabbing at your face too frequently. Angle your hat, taking care to tilt the round brim towards your chin to take the sharp edge off your emotions. The bad dreams will follow after his body enters the ground. Brace yourself. You'll feel scattered, emotions all over the place like flying ants after the rain. You will see his face everywhere. You will think you are being followed. You will be right. After a week, You take to bed with a mysterious illness and he permits you to, even entering the bedroom to hold your cool hand and inquire solicitously about your health. The look in the president's eyes challenges you to cry openly or confess. You do neither. Plot. Your escape, your revenge, your next move. Be an exemplary wife for months. Make cryptic comments about bad influences. Claim to have been misled. Convince him you've changed. He will forgive you. He will not know that you will never forgive him. By the time you'll ask him to secure your position as head of the Women's League, you'll have buttered him up sufficiently, having ensured that everything will be as he wants it, that his needs are met even before he realizes what he requires. It is not solely the woman's backing that you need. Acquire the support of youth leaders, mostly men. They are not dinosaurs like the sycophants that surround your husband. They are modern, like you. None of them is over 45. Lavish them with gifts and business opportunities. Let them glimpse what life would be like under your patronage. Ensure that your popularity is entrenched. Speak at political rallies. Hear the applause grow louder at everyone. Your ambition grows with it. You'll do this over a matter of years. Slowly entrench your presence in the country's politics. See comprehension dawn on your enemies' faces as they realize how serious you are. Your husband is no longer the authoritarian figure he was. Tall, forbidding, back ramrod straight. His shoulders droop. He falls asleep at the dinner table. Still, he is respected and revered, and what he says counts, and he has crowned you his political heir. Watch army tanks roll in an inexorable march towards the presidential residence. Hear the onerous clank, the metallic tread on tarmac, and realize that this is the soundtrack to your demise. Smell the tear gas in the air, the scent burning your nostrils, pinpricks of moisture scalding your eyes. It will be a hot day, but you will shiver, your blood congealing in your veins. Your husband will assure you it is all for show. He is the head of the armed forces. They listen to him. Doubt him for the first time. You know how the army veterans hate you. You've heard the talk. Him they can forgive, they know his history, his credentials, but you'll be reduced to that thing between your legs, your only power that of a young woman to turn an old man's head. Chafe at this. It has always irked you, but that is of no consequence now. Attempt to rally your supporters. Arm a few members of the security forces still loyal to the president. Consider that people may do many things for money, but they are far more circumspect about losing their lives. There will be no battle. Instead, a half-hearted resistance as you hole yourselves up inside State House. They will take over the national broadcaster, their hateful faces beaming into homes. They will claim it is not a coup. In truth, your husband will be ousted by the army generals who once enjoyed his favor. They will convene a meeting with him, treating him with deference, maintaining the illusion that they are negotiating. But it won't change the fact that there will be gunshots around your home, that you and your children will be crouched down in the kitchen, huddled and humiliated. One officer, bolder than the rest, will tell your husband that while they are sorry for betraying him, they could not allow you to ascend to his position. Even during the meeting, they will look around, and you'll imagine them as vultures assessing your collection of expensive furniture as if it were carrion, calculating what they will take. Envisage corrupt Swiss bankers wondering whether they can siphon the cash you have stashed away. You've heard the stories. You know what happened in the Congo. It is only a matter of time. You'll be spirited away in the dead of night, concerns for your safety finally upending your pride. He will call you from time to time, inquire about the children, meet you continents away when he has to travel for medical treatment, but they will not chase him from his country like a dog. They will invoke witchcraft to explain your influence over him. You lured him. You are a siren. You dashed his legacy on the rocks. There will be calls for retribution. People will want you to do penance. You will not be just an African president's wife. You will be Eve and Delilah. You will be every temptress that ever lived, every bringer of bad things. They will absolve him of responsibility, his sins washed away in history, receding from memory the way waves retreat from the shore. He can stay, they will say, but you must leave.